If your knowledge of Scottish cuisine is limited to haggis and whatever you've learned from Groundskeeper Willie on The Simpsons, today you're in for a treat. My guest is Gary McLean, the National Chef of Scotland. Prior to our conversation, I had little knowledge about Scottish food and cooking, which is why I wanted to have Gary on the show. I'm guessing that many of you also don't know too much about Scottish cuisine, so today is the day all that changes. This is Chris Spear, and you're listening to Chefs Without Restaurants, the show where I speak with culinary entrepreneurs and people working in the food and beverage industry outside of a traditional restaurant setting. I have 31 years working in kitchens, but not restaurants, and currently operate a personal chef business throwing dinner parties in the Washington, D.C. area. Do you remember that SNL skit in the 90s with Mike Myers? He ran a shop called All Things Scottish, and whenever a customer walked in the door, bagpipes played, and he yelled, "Welcome to All Things Scottish. If it's not Scottish, it's crap." I'll save you my attempt at a Scottish accent there. Well, besides that and some haggis jokes, I hadn't had much exposure to Scottish cuisine or culture, except maybe when it comes to whiskey. I have spent some time in the UK, but only in Wales and England, and we do talk about some of the similarities and differences there. But that's why I was really excited to have Gary on the podcast. He's Scotland's first national chef, a role he was offered after winning MasterChef The Professionals in 2016. Gary also recently released a new cookbook for North American audiences called The Scottish Kitchen. It's somewhat of an adaptation of a book he released last year. He adjusted some of the recipes to take into account ingredients that were available to us here in North America. For instance, you can't buy sheep lungs legally in the US for haggis. And while you might assume to just add more liver, which is something I would have assumed, he actually suggests adding ground pork or chicken to keep it from tasting too livery. Gary's also a teacher, and we discuss the importance of culinary education and teaching children about food and nutrition from a young age. We also talk about his MasterChef experience and what he considers to be the best culinary products in Scotland. He likes to remind people that Angus beef is a Scottish breed of cattle, of course. So if you're new to Scottish cuisine and like learning new things like I do, I think you're going to enjoy this episode. And a little teaser for next week, I'll be releasing my episode with Tiffany Thiessen. You might know her from her time on Saved by the Bell and Beverly Hills 90210. But she's also a two-time cookbook author, so that will be out next week. In the meantime, if you want to stay connected, go to chefswithoutrestaurants.org. From there, you'll find links to our Instagram and private Facebook group for culinary entrepreneurs, as well as the link to sign up for our Chefs Without Restaurants newsletter and more. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please share it. And the show is made possible with the help of our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by the United States Personal Chef Association. So this week's episode will be coming right up after a word from the USPCA. Are you a personal chef looking for support and growth opportunities? Look no further than the United States Personal Chef Association. With nearly 1,000 members across the U.S. and Canada, USPCA provides liability insurance, certification, lead generation, and more. Consumers can trust that their meal experience is insured and supported by USPCA. And now, for a limited time, save $75 on new membership and get your premier listing on Hire a Chef by using the code TAXBREAK2023 at USPCA.com. That's capital T, capital B. Plus, if you have products or services to sell chefs and their clients, showcase your business on Hire a Chef and USPCA websites with our great introductory packages. To learn more about membership, advertising, or partnership opportunities, call Angela at 1-800-995-2138, extension 705, or email aprather@uspca.com. Hey, Gary, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having us. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to you today. You know, I selfishly like to have people on the show who can teach me something, and I don't know anything about Scottish cooking or cuisine, really. And yeah. I think you're probably the guy to talk to, right? You talk about Scottish cuisine a lot.
Yeah, I do. I'm Scotland's national chef, and I also write cookery books based on historical and contemporary Scottish food. So yeah, I know a lot about Scottish food.
How do you get to be the national chef of Scotland?
I was actually asked by the Scottish government. I did the TV show MasterChef The Professionals. You guys have it there. I think Gordon Ramsay, a fellow Glaswegian, is the main host on your show.
I think I've heard of him.
We have three MasterChef shows in the UK. One is the regular one that yous have got. We've got a celebrity one, and we have a professional one. So we have professional chef that go on MasterChef and compete against each other. So I did that a few years ago and managed to win it. And I had about 15 minutes of fame. And during that time, the Scottish Government asked me if I'd be interested in supporting it and being Scotland's national chef.
So what does that mean? I assume your responsibilities are kind of raising awareness of Scottish cuisine. Is that the long and short of it?
To be honest, it isn't. That particular part is not in my remit. I was given this kind of big dossier of about 4,000 things that they would like the national chef to do. And I picked two things, you know, if I was going to do it and make any impact at all, there was no much point trying to do everything. I thought, I'm going to stick to really what I'm passionate about. And one of them was education and teaching kids to cook. So anything that would get young people into a kitchen and learning fundamental food life skills, I was happy to support. And I also support food charities who are feeding people who wouldn't normally have food. And that's my main objective in Scotland. When I travel, I stick my chest out and tell the world what an amazing place and what amazing food Scotland's got. And I support export of Scotland's food and drink.
What do you think Scotland does best food-wise? Like, what are the products you really think are top-notch and say we have the best?
We, without a doubt, have the best fish and shellfish. Scotland has got more coastline than France and Spain combined. We've got the perfect geography and environment for fish and shellfish. Just due to, you know, luck, I suppose, luck and weather and things like that. But we also have the Gulf Stream that comes up from South America right across the Atlantic, and it runs right up the west coast of Scotland. So what that does, it's a constant supply of nutrients and food for our fish and shellfish. And it also raises the temperature of the water by a degree, which again helps boost. So that combined with environment, that combined with our weather and untouched seas, we definitely provide the best fish and shellfish in the world, without a doubt. And I can say that.
I'm from New England, and I think of, you know, like we have lobster coming from Maine, but you guys have phenomenal lobster there, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I was doing a dinner last week in New Jersey, and I made a lobster bisque. And honestly, they're not a patch on a Scottish lobster for anything, you know, for weight, for the amount of meat you get in them, for the shell. I just really struggled getting the same flavour from Maine lobsters as I would do from a Scottish lobster. 20 Michelin star restaurants in Tokyo alone have Scottish lobster on the menu.
That seems like a secret. Like, I didn't even really know that until I started digging into your book.
If you even look at the States, you know, if you Google Scottish lobster menu, you know, New York, you'll find all the restaurants doing it's Scottish fish and shellfish that's on these three Michelin star restaurants. 11 Madison Park, for instance, used to have Scottish game and Scottish fish and shellfish on their menus.
And now they don't have any meat.
They don't have anything. I don't think they've got Scottish carrots.
I don't know who does the best carrots in the world.
I don't know. Even looking at vegetables and things like that. So Scotland produces seed potatoes, and those seed potatoes are transported all over the world. And fundamentally, if you're eating potatoes anywhere, probably with the exception of Canada and the US, you're eating a Scottish potato or a Scottish potato variety. Look at Angus beef. So Angus beef is a word that's used all over the US. Angus beef is a Scottish breed. So Angus is an area in Scotland where Angus beef comes from, or Angus cows come from. So, and that's the world over.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something in the back of my head. I probably knew it one time, but you just don't think about it on a daily basis here.
Yeah. I remind people all the time, especially when I'm in the States.
You know, I see, in my opinion, like some similarities to Scottish cuisine with a lot of other, you know, UK, whether it be Wales, England. Like, what are the similarities? What are the differences kind of in the cuisine there?
I think you'll find a lot of similarities in Scottish food right across the Northern Hemisphere. I think, you know, when I do demonstrations in New York or New Hampshire or, you know, up in New England, I always get someone in the audience going, oh, my gran used to make that, or my mum used to make something very similar. You know, and you've got to think along that sort of parallel, really, you've got a lot of Scots that did come to America and Canada and bring a lot with them. So if you're looking at immigration going back 400 years, and that's influencing Canadian food, American food, you know, and we're all using the same ingredients as well. That's the other thing, you know, what was available. Because all of our classic dishes, no matter where you come from, comes from what was available at the time. What could that particular class of people afford? How did they use up the bits that no one wanted? You know, for instance, things like haggis, which is probably our most famous food. I would
never heard of it.
So it's a kind of, you know, I think particularly in the States, I think most people get their knowledge of haggis from The Simpsons. You know,
sure.
Groundkeeper Willie occasionally mentions it. But there'll be a haggis dish in every culture because haggis is basically using up the bits that the well-heeled didn't want. So we just turned ours into something that managed to last the sort of length of time that it has.
Are you familiar with scrapple?
Exactly. Yeah. Everyone talks about scrapple all the time. Yeah.
We're in the land of scrapple here, so this is very much a Maryland, Delaware thing. Your cookbook was inspiring because you have so many interesting recipes using haggis, and similarly, if I ever have a cookbook, mine is going to have a whole scrapple chapter because it's one of those things. We eat it as a breakfast food here, but you don't see it in a lot of dishes, so I'll put it in a dirty rice. You know, a traditional dirty rice would have chicken livers. I use scrapple in there. I do a little fried popper, so to see that you had little haggis poppers there, I thought that was really interesting. I know over there you can buy it pre-made. Is the quality good? Like, I always had in my mind that it was something that everyone would just like make when they wanted. I didn't even think about the fact you could like go to the grocery store and have one. Although it seems like a tremendous amount of trouble to make.
To be honest, I have very rarely made haggis from scratch. And when I was writing the recipe for the book, I was writing the book for a North American market. Because in Scotland, even the very best chefs won't make haggis because haggis is made by butchers. So butchers make haggis, not chefs. Some restaurants will make things like venison haggis when they get in a whole venison and things like that. But the haggis that you buy is the best ever. It really is.
It's like making sausage. If I want sausage for dinner tonight, I'm not probably going to make my own sausage. Like, I have the culinary fundamentals, but I'm just going to go to the store or the butcher shop and buy it.
Yeah. And again, it's the butcher that's got the skill. And I'm lucky, I've got a really good friend who's a butcher. And over the years, where I've wanted to learn something or wanted to do competitions, so I do a lot of competition work with students, and I'm a culinary coach and all that sort of stuff. And when I want my students to stand out, if they go in and make a blood pudding, I don't want them taking the blood pudding in. I want them to make it. And I want my students to show the judges something they've never seen before. So I would then challenge my friends like butchers and things like that for their insight on how I can achieve that. And this is over the course of like 20 years where I've learned how to make things like black pudding and things like that and tatty scones and all these things that ordinary people wouldn't make. You know, tatty scones is in the book and it's basically potato and flour, and that's it, a little bit of salt. But we would never make a tatty scone because we can buy them for a dollar, you know, for a pound. We can buy the best tatty scones ever. But to write a book for a North American market that can't access these fundamentals, I had to learn them, which was quite an interesting journey for me.
So is this new book kind of I know you had a similar named book come out over there like a year ago. Is this that book pretty much like reimagined or tweaked a little for North America? Is it essentially the same book?
It's essentially the same book. It's got a slightly different name. It's got a different cover. And I have changed some of the names of things. And I changed the haggis recipe because you guys can't use lung. So when I go to America and get haggis, the butchers over there, they don't use lungs. They always put an extra liver, which completely changes it. It's not nice. It just
too livery.
It becomes too livery, too gamey. So I've replaced that with, I think there's an option of ground chicken or ground pork. And basically what, as you know, as a chef, lungs don't actually taste of anything, but they provide, you know, they bring things together a wee bit like an egg white, I would think. you know, when it's boiled and minced, it's a filler as opposed to something that's going to flavour. And I was trying to think of something, how would a bit of ground pork in there work to create that fill that doesn't give you that livery taste? But the reality is the book was, I've got a Scottish publisher, but the book was written for the American market because I spend a lot of my time in the US and I do demonstrations. And my first book that came out was a cookery course. So I wanted to teach people to cook. So I had everything in there. I had, you know, basic sauces, how to chop an onion, how to break down a chicken, how to make a beef gravy, how to make a curry, how to make a risotto properly, how to make pastry, and all these fundamental skills that you would have learned at school. That's what I wrote. And then I started traveling and going to the States, and I became Scotland's national chef. And I had this book out, and everybody was buying the book thinking it was Scottish. I mean, I had a woman come up to me in New York and said, I totally loved your Scottish tiramisu. It was the best I've ever tasted. And I had to explain to her that it was actually an Italian tiramisu. It wasn't
just
Scottish.
Cooking fundamentals.
So I kind of, it was called Kitchen Essentials, that book. And it was going back to my kind of teaching, my teaching days of, and I just wanted to get a really good cookery course for folk who probably wouldn't cook much. So I felt I owed North America a book that was Scottish. So I wrote the book through lockdown. I bought every Scottish cookbook I could find, and I wasn't overly impressed with what I saw. And there was none that were really written for a modern kitchen. There was none that were written for the way we buy and shop. You know, a lot of the stuff I used in the book, a lot of recipes made the book because I could buy the ingredients from Amazon. You know, things like blood pudding, you know, I could buy the skins, I could buy dried blood, I could buy the little gun that pushes the mix into the skins. And, you know, sitting in front of my computer in this very room writing those books and logging into my Amazon account to see if someone could buy the ingredients that we need, it changed everything. And another thing I wanted to do was, as an educator, I write as I teach. So I put loads of detail in, I put in loads of things that, you know, I put in a little story about how I used to do it and it never worked very well, and this is how I do it now, and this is what I've learned, and it's a kind of journey. But every recipe's got a picture as well, which I think is important, and it's for a modern kitchen. So that was the sort of driving force. But again, it was very much, I was writing it for my pals in the US and Canada.
Well, I appreciate that because, you know, as a chef, I love to be, you know, I love to learn new recipes. I love to be inspired. I buy a lot of international cookbooks, but so often I will buy a book, let's say a Spanish cookbook, and then I look at it, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Literally half the ingredients I can't get here. Like, so at that point it's just inspiration, or I'm having to, you know, figure out a way to retrofit it with what I have. So to have a book where you said, oh yeah, don't, I would have put more liver in, like with the haggis. Yeah. If I didn't know, I would just look and say, oh, I can't get lungs, just put more liver in. So to have someone who's actually said, like, no, don't do that, here's what you're going to do instead.
But again, it was really, really pleasing for me that an American or Canadian publisher, Penguin, got a hold of the book and thought, this is perfect for North America. And when I went on, I had a couple of publishers who wanted to take it on, one in the US, one in Canada. And I was just so chuffed that they saw what the book was all about and what the market for that book was, you know. So, but I think within the book as well, there's loads of beautiful photography of Scotland. And again, it was one of my main sort of pitch ideas that we should be using the glorious landscapes of Scotland to share with the book, because I think it goes hand in hand, you know, food and landscape make that whole book.
It's absolutely beautiful. It makes me want to move there, you know. You clearly enjoy teaching. Where did that come from? Because, you know, a lot of chefs in the kitchen, they mentor and they teach, but I do think that, I don't want to say it's either something you have or you don't, but not every person who's a chef is necessarily a good teacher. So where does that part come from? Because you really seem invested in wanting to teach. You know, you talk about working with young children and just educating people like me and my audience. Where's that come from?
Yeah, I mean, my day job's in education. So I'm executive chef at the City of Glasgow College, and I've been at that college since 1988. So I was a student at that college. And when I was at college, there was no full time. No one went full time. Everyone was linked to their job. So I was part time. I used to do two nights a week twilight classes, and I did that for 8 years. I graduated, and then a year later, I was asked to come back and cover a class. So there was a lecturer who had to go to the dentist or whatever he had to do, and I was asked, would I come in and cover this class on this particular Wednesday? So it was one of the proudest moments of my life that I was asked to teach. So I went in, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. And I actually covered that class for 13 years. So I did every single Wednesday for 13 years at college.
That's a long fill-in period there.
I know. And I had loads of big, massive jobs. I was running some of the biggest food companies in Scotland. And I used to go for interviews for a next job or anything like that. And they would, they'd about to say, have you any questions? And I say, I don't have any questions, but I need to let you know that I need every Wednesday off. So I used to take every Wednesday off from my job and work the weekend so that I could teach. And then in 2010, I did the reverse. I went full-time college and part-time industry. And I've really been there ever since. It's been a massive, massive part of my career. It's been teaching and working in education. I'll be doing it till I retire.
I have a lot of people who I know listen to the show who are on the younger end. Maybe they're just starting their culinary career. So what would you say to someone who is maybe, 18, just out of high school or early 20s, and wants to maybe pursue a career in cooking? Do you have any advice, whether it be where to start or just anything you have?
I think the first thing to do is get in touch with your local college, getting qualified. Particularly in the US and Canada, it's vital, I think, because it's very difficult to move up that career ladder without the paperwork. And when you're younger, you don't appreciate that you need it. But if you can go to college, you should go to college, definitely. The other thing is you have to work in good places. So pick up a guidebook and find the best restaurant local to you and ask for a job. And the other thing is make sure you work for nice people. You've got to wake up in the morning and actually want to get out your bed and go work in that place. Because if you're in a job that you don't like or the people are horrible, find another one, because there's plenty of great kitchens out there with nice people who will look after you.
You've been in the industry long enough that I'm sure you've seen a little shift in that, right? Kitchens were not always the nicest, and they're not always still the nicest places to work.
I think there's a massive change, particularly since COVID. I think the hours have gone down. The money has gone up. And I think conditions and how people look after people makes a big difference. And the reason being, I think the next generation coming through are brighter than I ever was. They've got much more knowledge, and they've got all the information at their fingertips. They've got a mobile phone. So if they're having a bad day, they can go for their break, jump on the phone and get another job. Whereas when I was younger, there was no jobs. So if you'd managed to work in a great kitchen, you just had to grin and bear it, and stick in until you got it right. So it's completely different. It's a completely different world. And I think it's certainly a change for the better. And I think it's something I think all chefs have to work towards to make sure that next generation know that this is actually an amazing career. It's not all just bad hours and horrible people to work for. There's some great opportunities out there, and I know a lot of chefs that have got amazing stories to tell of where they've worked and where they've been and where they've traveled and things like that. It's a fantastic career. And I'm just glad I found food at a young age.
And you still, do you teach younger kids through your, volunteer time, how to cook or do some cooking?
Through my national chef role, I go into everything from kindergarten to elementary to high schools and other colleges, and I do in prisons and, wherever there's food, there's me, so I'm out a lot doing that kind of outreach. And I'm probably in about 4 schools a month at the minute. And it could be a kindergarten where they've converted a room into a bakery for little 3, 4, and 5 year old kids. So it's really interesting how people are engaging with food, we've got some primary schools in Scotland that are converting classes into kitchen, you know, so, because the need for young people to learn to cook is absolutely vital. And I'm not teaching them, to be chefs. I'm teaching them to live well. You know, it's teaching them a life skill that actually means life. And in Scotland, we've got some of the worst health statistics possible, you know, from strokes to diabetes to obesity. Scotland has it all.
Why is that? Do you have any insight?
I like to think it's a lack of food education at a young age. I think there's a lot of different factors. You know, there's, you know, inner cities and poverty. So people that are struggling will go to convenience foods a lot quicker than they would go pick up some fresh food and cook. Again, it's not just exclusively to Scotland, but we seem to home in on it a lot more. You know, the life expectancy of poor people from inner cities is, you know, like 2/3 of what it would be just a mile, you know, up the road. You know, so there's a lot to do. And I think that if we teach young people to cook, you know, and it's a slow burn, and this isn't just, again, in Scotland, I think it's the whole Western world. If we teach young people to cook and understand nutrition and understand cookery process, I think their health will be better in their later years, which means there's less of a burden on everything else. Because obviously in Scotland, we pay for the sick. Everyone pays, everyone puts in for the NHS. So it's not insurance, it's not self-provided. Anyone who's sick in Scotland gets looked after for free because of the NHS. And the cost of the NHS every year is just going up and up and up. And it's down to, you know, diet and lifestyle. A lot of it is.
My wife's a registered dietitian now. She used to be a chef. So she kind of has combined her backgrounds and
that's
she does
an amazing
a lot of
combination.
Yeah. Yeah. She went to culinary school with me. She actually did her internship in Wales for culinary school, which is how we got this love for being over there. She worked at the Celtic Manor in Caerleon.
Oh, amazing. So did she go to Cardiff College?
So she went to Johnson & Wales University in the U.S. here in Providence. And then we have the opportunity to go anywhere in the world to cook. And she wanted to go overseas and just started looking at properties. So she went on and did 3 months living there and cooked. And then hadn't been back in 20-something years. So in October, we took, I have 11-year-old twins. So the whole family went over there and we made a trip across the UK, going all through Wales and England for a little over a week.
I like that part of the world. It's a hell of a place to get to from Scotland. I did a charity dinner in Cardiff just days before the COVID thing. And my flights got cancelled like hours before. So I ended up having to drive to Cardiff. It took about 9 hours and then do a full 15-hour shift doing the dinner. But you know, that was my first time in Cardiff.
So looking at your MasterChef experience, did you ever dream of going on TV or a culinary competition? Like, how did that come about? I've had a few guests on the show who've been on MasterChef, both in the US and in Canada. What was your experience?
I absolutely loved it. And the reason I did it is because we use MasterChef professionals as a teaching tool. So at the start of our show, they bring in six competitors one at a time, and they do a little background on them, you know, and normally they're head chefs of Georgian Mansion, Three Rosette restaurants and all that sort of stuff. So they really big up these chefs and they do the hero shots and all that sort of stuff. And they show them in their restaurant cooking their best plate of food ever. So they look amazing. Straight after their introduction, they wheel them into the kitchen, the studio, and they do a what's called a skills test. And the skills test could be something as simple as crepe Suzette or fillet and fish or something, basic task. And 9 times out of 10, the chefs really make a mess of it. So the following morning after the shows, the students will come in, the first year, second years will come in and go, chef, did you see so-and-so from wherever who couldn't bone a chicken out? And as a lecturer, for me, it was a great tool to say, guys, this is why you're devoting your time to learn these fundamental, the foundations of cookery. You know, because the first years can fillet a fish, they can bone out a chicken, they can bone out a saddle of lamb, all those sort of good skills that a lot of chefs who don't go to school don't pick up, you know, that just bypasses them, whatever they've worked, they just don't know how to do it. So it's a great tool for us. In conjunction with that, I was the college culinary coach, and I started the team, and we won everything, you know, I did it for about 6 years before I did MasterChef. And we won everything. I think we won about 20 UK titles and about 5 or 6 international titles in India and America and places like that. And so my students started sort of pushing me, saying, well, put your money where your mouth is. You can coach us how to win. Can you do it yourself? So I applied, and there's like a big 10-page application, 5 telephone interviews, and I made the sort of screen test part of it. And I went in, I had the most amazing interview ever. And I came out and I phoned my wife and I says, I think I'm in. I was terrified, shaking. I think I'm in, because you're applying, but you're kind of hoping you don't get in, if that makes sense, because it is quite scary. And it's a don't call us, we'll call you scenario. And they never phoned me and I never got in. So I was absolutely livid that I never got in. So I applied again the following year, and with a bit of reflection, I kind of thought, I went too smart. I went too much as a college lecturer. So I went with a Star Wars t-shirt and a pair of denims and did the worst interview ever. And I came out and I phoned my wife and I says, look, I think I'm in. I says, that couldn't have went any worse. They're probably going to get us in as cannon fodder, so to speak, as I thought they did. And I never get in. And again, I thought that was enough for me. I just couldn't handle the rejection anymore. And one of my students, the third year, he said, are you applying again this year? And I said, nah, I've had it. I'm not doing it again. I can't take the rejection. And he said, today's the last day of applications. So anyway, I sent the students off on a break. I went to my office and I sent the previous year's application. I changed the dates and got to the screen test again. And I went smart casual and grew a beard and got in. Keep trying.
Third time's a charm. Isn't that the expression?
Third time's a charm, yeah.
But cooking, like, it's very different. And I've never been on TV, but like having the lights, the camera crew there filming, it's very different than being in your natural environment of a kitchen. Like that's, people say to me all the time, you should go on Chopped or something like that. I don't think I could deal with the pressure, the anxiety of that, having them in my face, having this very unnatural type of environment. Just, I think it's not for everyone. So yeah. I can understand obviously being nervous and, you know, maybe not butchering a chicken so well or filleting a fish there. It's got to be tough.
Yeah, no, it is. And the way they set it up as well, you know, it's the first time that the competitors see a camera. It's the first time they see the presenters and they see the studio and stuff like that. But I was kind of lucky because obviously I had a whole load of competition experience. So I understood. And obviously when you teach, you understand timings really well and you understand presentation and you understand keeping neat and tidy and all those other kind of core skills. And I also did a lot of TV prior. I'd done quite a lot of TV. There was a show in Glasgow, a live show, cookery, kind of magazine show that I did. And I think I did it about 50 times. And live TV, when you've got 3 segments of 50 seconds each, takes a lot of planning, a lot of timing, as well as performance. So I think between lecturing and having that little bit of TV experience, I think it really helped. Because I wasn't frightened of cameras because they weren't live. You know, I knew that no one, there's 5 million people behind that camera eventually, but they weren't there at the time. You know, and you're filming all day for an hour show. So you're hoping that they're going to get your best bits as well. But my first TV experience was actually in the States. I did some TV in Chicago.
Oh, what was that?
About 25 years ago. It was Breakfast TV, WGN. So that was my first live cookery spot on TV was there. And I was recently back on their show 2 or 3 months ago. I was invited back on after 25 years of not being there, which was quite strange. Same presenters, which was pretty cool.
Guess it must be a good job for them if they've been there that long.
It must be, yeah.
That's crazy. I guess being on the show led to some great opportunities. It allowed you to put Scottish cooking front and center. I mean, on the show, were you cooking all Scottish type dishes, or was the format where you were doing other things and being a little more experimental?
You know, it's funny because when you're getting flung into that environment, you know, I thought before you get in, and probably most people think when they're watching MasterChef, that the person's cooking a dish they've done 1,000 times and they've had 2 weeks of practice. The show is day after day after day after day. And if you get through one show, you get the challenge for the next show. And I never, ever considered myself as being a Scottish chef. But when you're under immense pressure, you're pulling from your repertoire the best things that you know. You're pulling the things that impress judges. And every single dish I did was Scottish. And it wasn't until I came away from it with, you know, 30 dishes on the show, and every single one of them would make a Scottish cookbook. You know, and it's you reverting back to your, I think, your primal skills. So it was kind of weird. And I kind of said towards the end to my other competitors, if I don't get a job with the Scottish Tourist Board after this, you know, I've messed up. And on the show's massive over, I mean, it's shown in 100 countries and everything else, but it's huge. And I got 7,000 emails in one day. So I woke up the following morning and everything was broken. My phone had, you know, millions of messages, everything else. And I answered every email. I answered every WhatsApp message. I answered every LinkedIn, Twitter, everything. And it took me 3 months to find the email from the Scottish Tourist Board offering me a job. I missed it.
But when was that? So was that after you won that you got all the messages?
After I won, yeah. Yeah. So again, I think you've got to think, you know, a Scottish guy winning MasterChef was quite a big deal, but a Scottish educator, a Scottish teacher winning professional MasterChef was a major deal. And obviously when, you know, we've got X Factor and, you know, Britain's Got Talent and stuff like that. You guys got America's Got Talent. If there's ever any Scottish folk on these types of shows, the whole country gets behind them. So rather than, you know, if you're from Devon, everyone from Devon supports you, but or if you're from, you know, South of Wales, everyone from South of Wales supports you. But in Scotland, everybody unites and, you know, they get behind you. So it was an incredible experience.
Well, I'm sure to the layperson, you know, it kind of gets a bad rap cuisine-wise. I think the generalization, both of yours and British cuisine, is like it's kind of bland. There's not a lot going on. You know, I don't think a lot of people have had experience with it. So to be able to kind of get up there and show people that you've got some of the best products in the world and some really delicious recipes, obviously everyone's going to want you to be the representative for the country's cuisine.
But I think there's a big change in how people think of food, and that's from a chef's point of view and a general public's point of view. I think people in the last sort of 10 years are totally embracing their local ingredients and local produce, but also the local traditions and family recipes. And I see that all over the place wherever I travel, whether it's, you know, in Asia or Europe or North America. People are really embracing their own food. You know, I opened a Scottish restaurant in Glasgow. Again, it must have been about 20 odd year ago, called The Boffy. And I was opening lots of restaurants at the time. And I had Indian, Italian, French, pizza, pasta, burger places, American places, all sorts of stuff. And I remember I was opening my 7th restaurant in the same street. They're almost next door to each other. And I literally ran out of ideas. I ran out of what to do. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do with this site? It's my job to come up with the concepts. And I thought, right, why don't we do Scottish in Scotland, in Glasgow? And I remember going to the owner. We had a round table that we would discuss and dissect ideas. And I went to this idea of opening a Scottish restaurant in Scotland was so unusual. I wanted to speak to the actual owner first before I pitched it, this crazy idea, to the rest of the team. And he loved the idea. And I remember the press and the coverage the restaurant got because we opened a Scottish restaurant in Glasgow. It was kind of revolutionary. Even 20 odd years ago, it was quite revolutionary, you know, opening a Scottish restaurant in Glasgow. And it sounds bizarre now. And now in Glasgow, most restaurants are open with Scottish element, whether it's an Indian or Indonesian or French or whatever that concept is. Their core will be Scotland, their core will be Scottish ingredients. And it's a massive change, and I think it's a good change.
What cuisines do you love? What are some of your favorite beside traditional Scottish food? Oh, like, what do you enjoy?
I think at home, you know, obviously I've got five kids, and they're all very different. They're all got very different tastes and things like that. Asian food's good. Indian. I go to India quite a lot, so I do like Indian food. In Scotland, people really like Indian food. I suppose you've travelled in England as well. There's a lot of Indian restaurants.
Absolutely.
A lot of very good Indian restaurants. You know, I quite like everything. I do like getting to the east coast of the States. I do like those, you know, in Maryland, I do like those seafood shacks, you know, where it's, you know, Old Bay seasoning and stuff like that. I do
Old
like
Bay.
All that
Everyone's
as well.
Got Old Bay. I have friends with Old Bay tattoos. You know, it's a way of life out here.
I've got Old Bay in my restaurant in Edinburgh. I've got an Old Bay dish, and no one knows what it is. I like the smell it gives off. It's a seafood restaurant, so I'm trying to emulate those restaurants I've been in Maryland.
And with your recipes in your books, how do you balance tradition with kind of innovation or contemporary ideas? Like, it's a fine balance, right?
Majority of it's traditional, written in a contemporary way. I would say that would probably be the vast majority of those dishes are definitely traditional. So if you hand that book to an expat Scottish person in the States, they would flick through it and recognize pretty much everything that's in there.
Well, good. I'm going to have to practice some of those recipes. I have a person who's contacted me 2 years in a row to do a Burns Night dinner. And I'm like, I don't know anything about any of this. You have got the wrong guy here. I've not attempted it. So maybe I take the book, I practice some things, and this year I say, hey, you know what? Why don't you give me a shot? I'm going to take a stab at this.
I think what you'll find in the book as well, that each dish has got a story. You know, and a lot of those dishes in that book I've actually served at Burns Suppers and St. Andrew's Nights in the US and Canada. So there's a lot of dishes there. So, you know, it's a one-stop shop for the perfect Burns Supper.
What is one message or hope you have that every reader of your books or listener of this podcast takes away? If there's something that you really want to drive home about Scottish cooking, what would that be?
I think the big thing when I write is I'm trying to make it a user-friendly book. So I want to see that book not on a shelf or in a, you know, on a coffee table somewhere. It needs to be in the kitchen getting covered in gunk. It needs to be getting used. And don't be frightened to try something new. And the other thing, don't want to sound like a boring old teacher, but no matter what the book is, whatever the recipe is, read the whole recipe first before attempting it. So you know where it's going, where the direction is, and you can plan ahead a wee bit. I think that would be my advice. But just get.
I've made those mistakes in my early days. Like, you just look and you start the recipe and don't realize that it's like a 3 day something. Like, something's got to chill.
Marination,
right?
And yeah. But again, exactly. There's very few recipes in that book that you can't just pick up and go on with. And there's a massive amount of recipes in that book that are four ingredients. You know, because traditionally, when we, you know, all our ancestors, they didn't cook for fun. They cooked because they needed to live, you know, and they didn't have the same choices we have with food. So they were cooking what was available. And a lot of traditional recipes are very, very few ingredients because it's about survival. It's not about showing off to your pals for a dinner party or changing it up at the weekend. You know, they were cooking to survive. And that's what I love about traditional food from all over the world.
I think there's been a resurgence in that. You know, I love that so many more people are interested in cooking and food these days. But when I think of the past decade and a half of all the cookbooks I've gotten and all the restaurants and things, you know, I'll buy these cookbooks and you look at these recipes and there's like 80 ingredients and all these specialty things. And I think, oh, this is interesting as a coffee table book, but I'm not going to pull it out on a Tuesday night. I mean, I work, I have kids. No, I want good, solid food that I can put on the table quickly.
I think it's good if you're a chef and you pick up one of those books and you're learning something and you're taking, you know, one of my favorite books, going back to 11 Madison Park, their book's stunning. And some of the, you know, their food is on the surface, like all good food, looks really simple. And then there's 4 pages of recipes. But if I can pick 3 things from the 20 things that they're putting on that plate and learn something, it's worthwhile for me, particularly when I do dinners or dinner parties or looking for new ideas for restaurants and things like that. You know, it's certainly worthwhile. But I write for the home cook, and I never ever forget that it's a home cook that's going to have to find those ingredients and go shopping. And I remember my first book, and when you write your first book, you've got 1,000 ideas because you've already got 1,000 recipes because you've got your whole lifetime of ideas. In that particular book, I kind of wrote what I liked. And I remember I wrote the book, and then I went to do the photography, which means that meant I had to go buy the food. And I'm looking at a recipe, and I'm looking at the ingredients, and I'm going, I can't be bothered buying all that. What am I going to do with the ingredients? What am I going to do with this? What am I going to do with that? And I just didn't put it in the book. And I just picked something different that was simpler and much more user-friendly. You know, it's got to be user-friendly. And the price of food just now as well. I mean, I was quite shocked last week when I was buying food in New Jersey. It's expensive.
It's a lot.
You know, it's went up a lot in the last, certainly the last 3 years since I've been back there.
Oh yeah, I was just talking about this the other day on my social media. Short ribs, beef short ribs, I think are up 23% in cost since like January. It was something like, it was like $9.99 a pound, and then it hit like $11.99 a pound, and now it's like $14.99, and that's from January. And that's just like one item. To have a 23%, you know, food cost increase is crazy. And we're seeing that scaled out across the board, not just with food, but with, you know, so much more than that.
Yeah. I mean, I bought a cucumber that was $3.
Must be a really good cucumber.
It actually wasn't. I mean, in Scotland, we'll probably pay about 75 pence for a cucumber. $3. Little tiny packet of herbs, $3. You know, it was crazy. So again, I'm very conscious of that because I've got a family of 5. So feed our 5 kids. I know it's not easy. It's not easy feeding everyone and having the time to do so. But that's what that book's all about. I mean, the book is definitely Scottish, but the core of that book is about family cooking.
Well, I think that's a great point that you went to photograph the dishes, and it wasn't really until you got to that point and said, I've got to get all this stuff. You know, I've had to look at the same thing with my personal chef business because my menu changes literally every day because I cook for different people. And I tried to be fancy, and this salad has pecans, and this salad has walnuts, and this salad has cashews. And then spread out over a course of a week, I was buying like hundreds of things for all these dinners. And it's like, no, I need to streamline this. So the menu says nuts on this salad, right? And we're just going to go with what do I have on hand this week?
So I'm not buying.
Yeah. You know, to streamline the pantry because having all that stuff is just not realistic. So.
And again, at the beginning of the book, I've got a little note to say, just chill out, you know? So if the recipe says a pound of ground beef, and you've got a pound and a half, don't separate the half. Just get the whole lot in. It won't make a difference.
Leftovers
so just
for lunch
chill out
tomorrow.
When cooking. Yeah, you end up with something for lunch, and it won't make a massive difference to the recipe. The only exception to that is, as you know, is when you're doing anything with flour and butter and sugar. You know,
you can't just throw an extra quarter cup of flour in and make a pastry expect it to come out, right?
It's a kind of formula that needs to be followed. So other than that, everything else you can subtract or add ingredients that you like or don't like.
Definitely. Do you have any final words or anything you want to share with our listeners before we get out of here today?
No, it's just good fun. Hopefully, I'm in the States a lot doing events. So look me up, give me a shout. My next event is in New Hampshire at the Loon Mountain, at the New Hampshire Highland Games up in Lincoln, New Hampshire. So hopefully see you then. And then I'm back in November doing the Wallace Awards on Fifth Avenue for the American Scottish Foundation. So if you manage to get to that, it'd be good to see you. And I might be doing some book signings and things as well in between.
Very cool. Well, as always, I put everything in the show notes so people will be able to find you. They'll be able to check out some of your videos. Definitely pick up the cookbook. So I appreciate having you on the show today. It was really great talking to you.
Chris, lovely talking to you.
Thank you. And as always, to our listeners, this has been Chris with the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast. Thanks so much and have a great week. You're still here? The podcast's over. If you are indeed still here, thanks for taking the time to listen to the show. I'd love to direct you to one place, and that's chefswithoutrestaurants.org. From there, you'll be able to join our email newsletter, get connected in our free Facebook group, and join our personal chef, catering, and food truck database so I can help get you more job leads. And you'll also find a link to our sponsor page, where you'll find products and services I love. You pay nothing additional to use these links, but I may get a small commission, which helps keep the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast and organization running. You might even get a discount for using some of these links. As always, you can reach out to me on Instagram at Chefs Without Restaurants or send me an email at chefswithoutrestaurants@gmail.com. Thanks so much.